Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Bob Lewis. I'm chair of the Canadian Journalism Foundation, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this, the last of J-Talks for this season. We'll shortly be announcing our lineup for the spring. I also want to thank, as always, BMO Financial Group for their generous support of this series. And a special hello and thank you to Waste Management for the reception. I want to make one brief pitch in that we are dependent entirely on donations from corporations and institutions, and we also encourage friends of the Canadian Journalism Foundation to contribute, which you can do online. And as we near the end of our budget year, we'd appreciate any support you can extend to us. This event's being live streamed, and for those of you watching, you can submit questions at the hashtag CJFJTalk. Now, I've been warned by Steve Paikin that I was not to introduce him with any formal remarks. And as a journalist, Steve, that made me suspicious. And so I started doing some investigation. And I happened to be having coffee with David Crombie this week. And I said, Paikin doesn't want me to introduce him with any bio. And I said, what is he hiding? And Crombie said, well, it's simple. You do know he's from Hamilton. So without further ado, I'd like to bring you the host who wants to put the focus on his guests and not on himself, Hamilton's own Steve Paikin.
Perfect. All right. Oski wee wee. Thanks, Bob. That was great. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome this evening. We're going to have what we hope will be a nice engaging discussion to start with, and then as you can see from the microphone being in the middle of the room, we want to take your questions and get some real good engagement going back and forth as the night goes on. Before I do this, it is rare that I get this kind of opportunity to both praise and embarrass someone who's in the hall tonight, but I'm going to do that because as I was coming up in journalism 30 years ago, he was my hero. And yes, Fraser Kelly, I'm talking about you. You're sitting in the back where you think I can't see you, but Fraser Kelly is back there. Fraser was, of course, the anchor at CFTO and CBC and was the moderator of the 1975 Leaders Debate, which nearly was you have to be of a certain age to remember that one, but Bill Davis and Bob Nixon went at each other with boxing gloves like nothing I've ever seen since, and you were very cool. You were a cool customer. And he's really happy because his daughter Heather is back in town after 20 years of being in Asia. So welcome back, Heather, and Fraser, it's a delight to be with you tonight as well. How about a nice hand? There we go. You all know the show The Newsroom? That's a bit about what we're going to talk about tonight, so we thought it might be fun just to start with a clip of that. Then we'll introduce our gathering, and then we'll get off to the races. So Mike, if you're back there, roll the tape, please. Audio. Audio is obviously a federal responsibility.
This woman is the best I've ever seen. Center screen is Nancy. These three corners are live feeds of the guest experts.
What are they experts in?
Agreeing with everything Nancy says, but what keeps your attention?
Excuse me.
This is Brian Brenner, everyone. It's possible he's going to be writing a feature on 2.0, but we're in a tryout period right now. Everything's off the record. Go ahead, what keeps our attention?
Is the bottom right corner where they're playing a loop of little Kaylee from a home video.
Question, hell. Do you think it's as bad as everyone says it is?
That was actually a tribute to Kaylee. But how will they explain the duct tape around the child's mouth and nose? And how will they explain all the lies that Top Mom told?
Now, they're not talking about the tattoo on Casey's back, but they put it full screen. Why? Because Tess was just about to look somewhere else, so they changed the frame to anything that might keep her attention.
He's right. I was going to Google Max Hell question.
Plus, tattoo equals bad mom. No one's ever gone broke in America serving up a woman who makes other women feel superior.
The series of lies that finally came crashing down around her. If she would lie about that, why should I believe an accident? is true.
Don't spend time thinking about her airtight syllogism or EP showing duct tape in a plastic bag so you know you're watching the real CSI Miami.
Chloroform, how to make weapons out of home materials found in the home, about breaking necks. How can they explain that?
They can't explain it, Nancy. The defense is doing what the defense has to do. They may throw...
Now, Bill Schaefer's done his job. He agreed with Nancy. We don't need to see his face anymore. Look how cute Kaylee is. She deserved better than a mom with a tattoo. She deserved... she deserved...
me.
Me.
Me. Tess, how's that Google search coming?
It does look pretty bad. A lot of... fire.
You'll notice little of her coverage in this instance is about the law.
You know, come to think of it, I did notice
It's all
that.
Based on an emotional appeal, the way she would with a jury if there was no judge there to stop her. Watch how she breaks down courtroom footage.
Liz, let's see the video of Top Mom and Jose Baez back at it in court again today. Not a good look between a death penalty defendant and the lead defense attorney.
2 seconds. 2 seconds of Casey Anthony walking past her lawyer, and she'll show it to you in slow motion and from a different angle and at regular speed and from the original angle again. What does that remind you of?
Instant replay in sports.
And she looks pretty pissed at her lawyer.
And that's exactly why she's showing it to you so many times. So you have a chance to draw your own thoroughly uninformed opinion about an utterly innocuous exchange. She looks pissed. I wonder if she's sleeping with her lawyer. I bet she is. I wonder if that's what she looked like when she killed Kaylee. This is the best TV ever. I gotta go on my Casey Anthony Facebook page and see if my Casey Anthony Facebook friends just saw Casey Anthony make a Casey Anthony face at her Casey Anthony lawyer.
All right, enough. Will's a criminal prosecutor. Maybe he can talk about how our justice system wasn't built to lock up guilty people. It was built to keep innocent people free, which is something Americans should be proud of and fiercely protect.
No.
He can't ever imply that the viewer doesn't already know everything and that she might be innocent.
If we're gonna cover this, we're gonna cover it our way.
What's the point in covering it all unless we do it in a way that gets our audience back?
A modest proposal. We could ourselves commit murder on our air. In your face, Nancy Grace.
Any of that look familiar?
Gosh, I hope not.
Welcome, everybody. Say hi to Troy Reeb. He's the Senior Vice President of News and Station Operations for Global News, responsible for all news and related programming on Global and its associated websites and new media platforms, Global National, as well as news operations from all 12 Global stations across Canada. Wendy Freeman, President, CTV News, responsible for CTV News, responsible for news information, current events programming, digital platforms, including CTV National News, CTV News Channel, BNN, CP24, CTVnews.ca. Jonathan Witten, no, not the former tight end for the Dallas Cowboys, the executive director of news content at CBC, where he manages the fully integrated assignment and delivery of news content across platforms. Okay, I want to show you guys some numbers and then get you to react to this stuff, and hopefully we can bring this up here for everybody to see as well. A new survey conducted by Ipsos Reid on behalf of CJF finds that a majority of Canadians still prefer to consult the more traditional outlets to get their daily news fill. Let's go through this a bit. When surveyed, people said by 74% that they still like a regular newscast on a TV station for either evening or late broadcast. 60% still relied on community newspapers and magazines. 54% said the television station dedicated to only news or information 24 hours a day was still important for them. Down lower, 35% need social media sites like Facebook, 30% like the news aggregator sites like Google News, 28% 24-hour news-only radio stations, and only 10% apparently rely on Twitter. Okay, let's go through this. Troy, what do these numbers say to you?
It's first off that every single journalist who is reading each other's tweets on Twitter all day are drinking their own bathwater. But I think what this really says is that the biggest opportunity to successfully manage the transition to new media for journalism lies in the television broadcasters, and I'm going to assume that's why the three of us are sitting on this stage here tonight. It's a scary place for the newspapers, who we know for every dollar they gain in digital advertising, they're losing seven from their conventional print platforms. We haven't faced that in television, which does give us a stronger platform on which to build a new media base going forwards. And I think we have a responsibility to do that because we are starting on the same curve that the print guys have already gone down. And we will have just a rapid acceleration, I think, if we don't start to really manage the change and look for how we survive in the new media world.
Wendy, you look at those numbers and what do you think?
Well, I think actually most people would be surprised at these numbers, that people still turn to TV and the networks. And I think it shows that people still want the trust and tradition and the credibility that the networks provide. There is so much out there today on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube, but we gather it with credibility, with the trust, with the journalists that are experienced, and they still come to us to get that.
74%. Don't you wish it was 90?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I do. But we're the ones that sort of narrow it down and say, this is what's important. And people are still coming back and to us, to the traditional media, and I think it'll always be that way.
It'll always be that way.
I feel that way, yes.
Jonathan?
I guess not surprising the number, Steve. The thing that's pretty clear to us, that the look of this, is that television, particularly scheduled television news, will always be a part, I think almost always be a part of people's lives. There's no indication that that's going away anytime soon. Number of hours of people watching television now is largely stable. Number of hours within watching television where people are watching news, stable also. But what I think is probably missing from that, and I just brought a few numbers of my own here, which is that our own research would confirm that indeed 42% of people are looking for television for their primary source of news. What's missing there, though, is that 23% are looking to the internet. So obviously not any loss in terms of television where people are looking, but other things are creeping up. So 23% looking to the internet for their news, tablet ownership from 4% to 21% in the last 2 years. Smartphones from 27% to 44% in the next 2 years. So the challenge, I think, for all of us is not even an ability to think about in any way lessening our commitment to scheduled television news, but somehow adding in these additional things that we now have to deal with, smartphones, tablets, all the other stuff that's out there now. So it's not a question of giving up on one thing and turning to something else. It's a question of how do we, with limited resources, deliver on all of those platforms. And thinking about this question a little bit, you know, you can look at the fact that when the printing press was the main source of news, suddenly radio came along. It's not like the printing press disappeared. We simply added radio in. When television came along, we're simply adding television to radio to the printing press. So this is nothing new, but as these things get added, and as for many of us now, we have to deal with all of them, it becomes much more of a challenge. The numbers to me tell me that we can't ignore traditional television news watchers, but we have a whole bunch of other people that we now have to serve, and that's a challenge.
You really believe, Wendy, that people are still in the numbers they are at 11
o'clock? I do. I think they're still going to come to for us, because we have the journalists that have the credibility, the trust, the tradition. We're the ones that take all the stories and decide what's important for you to watch, and I do feel that they'll always come back to that. Old reliability.
And not to be wonky or academic.
Be a wonk.
But you know, the research, and I don't even think any research to show this, is that television and scheduled television will be a part of people's lives for a very long time. It has to do with wanting to relax and wanting to sit in front of something and to a certain extent be passive about what you're experiencing. It has to do with a family experience and sitting down with people. So I'm not, you know, it's not a question of that's all going away. It's a question of adding things in. And even when we're watching television now, and we're doing other things, which we've always done that. So now it might be we're on Facebook, we're on our smartphones. In the past, we were on the telephone, we were talking to people. That distraction's always been there. But certainly, that experience of sitting down and watching a scheduled news event will not disappear anytime soon.
Do you worry?
I'm going to disagree a little bit with Jonathan there, because the main word I'm disagreeing with is the word scheduled. And where we've really seen the bleed in viewers has been around the scheduled idea. And I'm not just talking about in television news. If you look at primetime viewing, the big hit shows that are in primetime right now are getting 30, 40, 50% of their audience, sometimes 80% of their audience from playback, from people who are PVRing it, from people who are watching it back on VOD. Because people want to watch those shows, absolutely. They love Hawaii Five-0, which airs on Global. But they want to see it on their time. They want to see it when they want. They want to see it instead of Monday nights or Tuesday nights at 10. Uh-oh. They want to see it, you know, when they're eager to see that. So they're watching it via playback. I think it's the same with news, that the idea of the 6 o'clock newscast and the 11 o'clock newscast is going to be a consistently challenged model because it doesn't fit in certain people's schedules. Now, there's a whole class of people who have actually built their day around that. I watch Lisa, then I go to sleep. I watch Donna as soon as I get home. But there are others who want to make...
Don't forget Pete.
Oh, they watch Pete.
Okay. Equal time.
Yeah, Steve. Not in the West, but they watch Pete. So So what happens is that people want to make it fit their lives as opposed to the other way around. So where we have really tried to put strategic import is on how do we do that? How do we actually take the credibility, the trust and tradition that you're referring to, and be able to place it at various day parts so that they can access that brand when they need it?
And that's part of it. And as Jonathan was saying, you need to add that in with at 11 o'clock with your tablet. You know, the four screens, as we always say. You know, the smartphones, that's a part of all of that. And bringing in viewers to at 11 o'clock with their tablets, with their smartphones, etc.
Do you folks worry at CBC that you are, you know, it's been 10 o'clock for so many years. It's been Peter Mansbridge at 10 o'clock for 25 years, right? Do you worry that with all of these other options out there, you cannibalize that audience at all?
We're already, through our news channel offering, the National, pretty well at every hour in every where you live in Canada, mm-hmm. right? So that's been the case for a number of years now. But I also think, just to not to disagree with Troy, but also to make the point that in terms of PVR penetration increasing, but starting to stabilize, I think, in terms of looking at where that's happening. And news and sports are, so far at least, the last bastions of places where people prefer it live. Mm-hmm. So absolutely on entertainment yeah. programming, but news, live sports, that's somewhere where, so far at least, PVR hasn't taken over. And so I still think that appointment viewing is important, and where we can offer it, as we do with the National 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, pretty well across the country, then that's valuable. You can watch the National at 6 p.m. in Vancouver, and despite what Troy says about the National being weak in the West, it's actually quite strong, and particularly that particular time in Vancouver. So that choice is offered through the news channel.
Yeah, well, I won't hold up numbers targeted. But I'll just say they exist. So I totally agree with the idea that PVR is not, you know, people aren't going to PVR news or sports very often. I mean, you get a very small number who it's like, okay, that's what I'm used to and that's what I want to watch that show, so I'm going to PVR it. But where entertainment programming has moved to PVR and on demand, news needs to move to accessible now. And that means accessible by mobile, accessible by online, or accessible in television. And I mean, my colleagues are well aware we're moving to a specialty model in the West. And
you want to just take a second and explain what that means?
Well, we're essentially, well, you've got CBC News Network, used to be News World. You've got CTV News Channel, used to be News Network. And before that was News One.
Yes.
But we're launching.
I wonder what yours is going to be called.
We're launching one called BC One, very similar to CP24 here in Toronto. We're not trying to pretend we invented the thing. But we believe that they're, you know, the strength of the global news brand is very much built on grassroots kind of news, news from your community, news from the perspective of the world from where you live. And we believe that there is a strong model to be had in putting news on a 24/7 available specialty channel at the local or regional level.
If I were to ask you who you do basically an 11 o'clock newscast for the whole country, and then of course all of these other things as well that I talked about at the beginning. So if I asked you, who is your prime competition out there, what's the answer to that?
Well, obviously these guys, but I would say everybody now.
Everybody means what?
Everybody, because everybody has, I'm going to show my BlackBerry. People now have this, and it's now the citizen journalist. It's everyone. And the fact of the matter is, you know, with Twitter and, you know, Iran was a perfect example where that was the only way stuff was getting out was by citizen journalists. And so we are now competing with everyone. And that's what we do every day now is, you know, everyone has a smartphone. Anybody could be a journalist. Anybody can shoot anything at any time. It's not just the major news organizations anymore.
When I was here last month to watch the newspaper publishers do their thing, the editors do their thing, and I asked somebody else asked the editor of the Toronto Star and the Globe and Mail, who are you in competition with? None of them said each other. They all said Google and Yahoo and all of this kind of thing.
Well, we're certainly still in competition.
We're absolutely still.
But we are absolutely,
yes.
For sure. But we are adding, you know, certainly newspapers are competition for us now, both text and video. And I think newspapers have, in many ways, teaching us about video to a certain degree, things that we hadn't thought of necessarily in terms of the way that we created video. So that's an interesting phenomenon that's happening. I will say that, you know, I agree with Wendy that to a certain extent, social media, people who are on Twitter are competition. I actually tend to look at it more as we're in this together to a certain extent. I think, you know, to me, two events that have happened in the last 5 years in Toronto, just to, I guess, to give an example of how things can change. One is the Vaughan tornado, which we may remember from 5 years ago. And there you saw, you know, a place where CBC, I don't think it's any secret, to a certain extent, moved away from local news 10, 15 years ago. We're now coming back into it, doing the best that we can. So certainly in the Vaughn tornado, you had CTV, CP24 having a huge advantage, a viewer base, people that were loyal to the brand, who were delivering content. And so that was a real competition thing at that point. But the Eaton Center shooting, which happened more recently, you actually saw where people who had video, who had facts, who had information, were sharing with each other. So even that notion of having an advantage 5 years ago is now kind of gone. And so I actually look at people who are doing that kind of journalism work as our partners to a certain extent. They're crowdsourcing, whatever you want to call it, where people are actually at events and tweeting and delivering information. Competition, yes, but also partners are a really important way to look at them, at least from our perspective.
Troy, let me get you. I wonder if your take's different. She's on at 11. He's on at 10. You're on before the supper hour with your national newscast. So are you really competing with these two in that regard?
Not directly, no. I think the what we're competing against is obviously their supper hour newscast or Coronation Street at 6:30 in Toronto. But it is a bit of a different news product, and we actually think that provides a value add for the viewer. Look, if you want to choose to have the more deep, contextual, value-added newscast after you watch your supper hour news, you're going to tune to us. If you prefer to get your full diet of local news at 10 in some markets from us, 11 in others, rather than watching the national, you're going to choose it from us. So it's competition, but it's the brand versus the brand as opposed to the national versus the national.
While you've got the floor, can you give this audience and the people who are watching us online a better understanding of the kinds of decisions that you've got to make during the course of a day, because we do not any longer live in the world that we all came up through, which was basically everything we do during the day is aimed at a single newscast that plays once and that's it. You're now all the time, everywhere, multi-platform. How does that change how you do what you do?
Well, I think the discussion about citizen journalism plays really well into that one, because what we saw in so many recent events, and Hurricane Sandy being the most recent one, where the floor of the New York Stock Exchange was flooded, and there were deaths in places where it turned out there weren't, and there was horrible damage that was done that turned out to not be true. And yet this information, as it came out on social media, was immediately re-reported by mainstream news outlets.
And then refuted.
Refuted. And as if somehow a half hour later saying, oh, no, that's not true. It turns out we've got new information, somehow makes it all go away. We're taking the position that that's not the case, that the value of our brand, and I don't know if my friends will agree or disagree with me, but that the value of our brand is really in its credibility. And we used to always have this race to be first. We had to be first with that information, and there's still some of that. But we've taken a step back from that to say, hey, let's make sure that the information people are getting from us is reliable, it's trustworthy, because if it's attached to that global news brand, people should be able to say, that's sound, I heard it there, and it's not, oh, half hour later, not true. So we're really taking the notion of, let's step back, make sure that there's credibility to it before we put it out there.
Wendy?
I agree with Troy. A tweet goes around the world like in seconds now. And it's not about being first anymore, it's about being right. And it's become a big part of what we do every day, because the stock exchange was a big example that night where CNN I think was reporting that it was underwater, and we checked our sources and it was absolutely not underwater, and we never reported that it was. And it's constant now. And it's no longer about being first, it's about being right, because all we have is our credibility and our reputation. That's the most important thing.
Jonathan.
I'll agree and disagree. First to agree that absolutely around social media, there has to be extra care taken. There are some broadcasters that are forming small units within the company to take a look at social media as it comes in, to evaluate it, to check it. We subscribe now to Storyful, which is an organization that does that for many broadcasters, where they take a look at the kinds of things that are coming from Syria, for example, or other big stories, evaluate it, check it on our behalf, in a sense, and deliver it. So absolutely,
we don't have the money that the public broadcaster
It's $100. It's $100 a month. So you can manage.
Outsourcing Canadian jobs to somebody.
That's right.
Per user, you can manage it, Wendy. But an area where I'm not sure I completely agree is that I think back to being in the control room not that many years ago when the Air France plane crashed at the Toronto airport, and talking to somebody on the phone during our live news special, saying that they had spoken to a police source at the airport and that everybody had lived in the plane, which of course, as you know, turned out to in fact be true. And my decision at that point was to not report that. And the thinking at that point was
to not report
the fact that one source on location had said that there were no survivors. And what's going through my mind at that point is there could be families watching who have people, you know, who have family members on that plane who are going to look at us and hear that everyone lived. And am I going to want to 10 minutes later then report that that wasn't true? Mm-hmm. When I think back at that, I think I would have done it differently. I think, you know, the way that we want to be trusted. We want to be a source people can trust. On the other hand, there's a sense now that information flows and it changes and it moves as things unfold. So agree, but also disagree in the sense that if we waited till the very end, I'm not sure, you know, I don't even think Wendy and Troy in the heat of the moment would necessarily be able to hold back to as long as they might say that they would in terms of having information that's fairly solid. One person tweeting that the stock exchange has water, that's a different situation mm-hmm. than somebody who I trust talking to a police source who she trusts at the airport. But you know, in a sense, it's a little different world now.
Yeah, I suspect the three of you watch a lot of American cable television. Yes, MSNBC, Fox, CNN, all of that. Okay, obviously the direction in the States on this. And I guess you two run your own all-news channels, and Troy, you're about to, so I want to get your take on this. The successful model seems to be, the most successful, is you got to come from a particular place on the political spectrum. MSNBC, obviously, from the liberal part. Fox, obviously, from the more conservative part. We know what Sun TV is doing in Canada in terms of following that model. Do you not feel, Wendy, any pressure to come from a particular political place on the political spectrum in your running of an all-news channel?
No, because we cover the news, and we don't make news, and the news is not about us. We are fair and balanced, and, you know.
Fox has that already.
Yeah, that's true. But
the real fair.
Our job at CTV is to cover the news and report the news.
And that's always going to be that way as long as you're running the show?
As long as I'm running the show, that's how it'll be.
Jonathan?
I'll only say two things on this question. One is the clip from the newsroom was interesting in the sense that it's fun to be able to look back on events that happened 2 years ago and rewrite the script. Wouldn't you love to do that, Steve, in terms of being able to create a fabulous environment where you can really relive things and be extremely smart and great about it. And other episodes have shown where they knew things other people didn't know. But of course, when you're writing something 2 years later, that's always a fabulous way to operate. And it's a way we can operate. For Troy and Wendy and myself, we're operating in the moment. We don't know anything. We, you know, that thing's written 2 years later. Second thing, which is interesting about that show, is that you have a host who, in a sense, was a popular host of a nonpartisan or a down the middle of the road news channel or a news program, who was attempting to somehow boost his rating or save his ratings by moving into a more partisan program. Which, of course, if you know the experience in the States, that's actually where the viewers are. Mm-hmm. So you know, in terms of the U.S. right now, it's not CNN. It is Fox or it is MSNBC. So that is definitely the business model, and it's great to hear Wendy say that. It's certainly not where we're going to go, but you absolutely have to look at the U.S. and say, in terms of a business model, having an angle, having a position seems to be where the audience is right now.
Okay, having said all that, do you think people already think, because you're a private broadcaster, that you come at things from a more conservative point of view, and because you're a public broadcaster, you come from things from a more liberal point of view? Wendy, do you get that?
We don't. You know,
you don't hear that?
I would hope that people think that we're fair and balanced. And, you know, no. And I was just going to point out, too, you know, CNN, yes, they're right in the middle, but when big events happen, people still tune to CNN. They are still the number one watched cable channel in this country.
Yeah, I think we need a little more perspective on that one, too, in that what we talk about, you said, you know, CNN seems to be the least successful, and if you looked at sheer ratings in the U.S., they are. But Fox and MSNBC really are not on any other cable systems around the world outside of the U.S. market. They're both available in the Canadian market. They're available in you know, somewhere in the Caribbean. But in terms of the rest of the world, they're not there. CNN is on almost every cable and satellite system in markets all the way around the world because it has become an international brand that in most corners of the world is viewed as very pro-American and very biased, but it still has a trusted sense to how it works. And it's also, you know, the one that can demand the highest fees from the cable companies in terms of subscriber fees, because it's the one that they feel is, you know, while they will have customers who will want to have Fox and they'll have customers who want to have MSNBC, none of them are going to get mad if CNN's included in their packages. So there's a whole other different kind of success that's That's
But in fine. Big breaking news, people, even in the United States, still turn to CNN, and especially in Canada.
Your BC One, is it going to come from a particular place on the political spectrum?
It's going to come from Vancouver.
I don't mean location. I mean politics.
No, it's not. I think the, and Vancouver has its own very unique place in the political spectrum. You know, you look at the, there was a time when CBC News World, in its early going, tried to go opinion, and they had a number of opinion shows. And
In prime time,
and none of them were particularly successful. There is a model, some people may have heard of it, in Canada now. It's not successful. There is an all news, I use that loosely, channel in Canada that is drawing, you know, very, very, very few viewers right now.
Sun.
And it's,
is that because they haven't been on the air very long and they're still not carried on?
Well, they forgot the news part of all news. And that is, you know, you look at Fox and where they've actually, you know, the newscasts that are at the top of the hour in Fox and the bottom of the hour and through most parts of the day are still pretty much straight up news. They're reporting it. Sometimes they have story selection that certainly caters to a more Republican viewpoint, but it's still straightly reported news. Where the impression, particularly among Canadians, comes that Fox is ridiculously right-wing is that it comes from its primetime talk shows. And these are talk shows in the same way that we have radio talk shows in this country and talk shows on Sun. What Sun's missing is any of that news to actually draw viewers there in the first place. There's no coverage of anything. It's talking heads only.
Okay. Let's try a little business right here. Bell, Rogers, Shaw, and I guess CBC basically own everything now. Everything. I'm exaggerating, but only a little bit.
You're exaggerating tremendously, Steve.
Okay, go ahead.
There is greater choice in this country for media than there ever has been. I take you back to people in the room to when you were a kid. There were maybe two or three channels on the dial. Not some of you. There were 100 channels on the dial when you were a kid. But but when you were a kid, there were two or three channels. And media in this country was dominated by the CBC, the government-owned institution. That is not the case anymore. Broadcasting has hundreds of channels now.
But they're all owned by the same people.
Many of them are owned by the same companies, but there are many, many independents out there, and there is such a diversity of voices in the online space. There are foreign voices coming in. There is greater choice in terms of where you choose to get your news than there ever has been before. So much, that's what's actually led to the consolidation, that if you look at the radio, what happened in radio, it used to be even a big market like Toronto would have 8, maybe 10 stations. Now, there's 3 times, 4 times that number, but one owner needs to own multiples because they have to be able to reach that same number of audience.
Is that good for the listener?
I think it is. It provides more choice.
Yeah. I think more choice is better for everyone.
But more choice is owned by fewer players. Is that better for people?
Well, I know that, you know, the fact that we're owned by Bell, we're able to do more. You know, they give us the financial resources to cover more news, to keep local stations open. It's a great thing.
Jonathan, what's your view?
Not to jump into you know what's better, what's worse. Only to make the point that we are the only national conventional television broadcaster that's not owned by a satellite and cable company. So for us, I think it's another reason for us to feel that we're vital to the news discourse in this country. And if the Bell Astral deal goes through, which they're trying to do again. We'll be the only national radio network that's also not owned by a satellite or cable provider. So again, for us, it really is it punctuates, I think, our value and our need to exist.
Wendy, do you share his analysis of the situation?
I think the public broadcaster absolutely needs to exist. I hope, God forbid, they ever go away. But I think in order for some of us to exist, we need these deep pockets.
Troy?
I won't comment on the whether or not the CBC needs to exist.
What?
License is up for review right now. Well, I mean, they get 6% of the audience, so clearly to those 6% of the audience, they need to exist. But what we have right now in...
What's that 6% refer to?
That's viewing share.
Yeah.
Television only?
Television.
English
I think
television.
The more competition and the more voices,
and what's global share?
The better.
Global share is about 9.5.
Right, so it's not six in the sense of six versus
right.
50. It's six. It's a share number. It's not a number that's a right. It's a very specific kind of number.
But the more voices we have in this country, the better, frankly.
I have to tell you, I'm loving the tension among you three up here right now. Yeah.
Now the competition is
good. We're eager to make it interesting.
And most of Troy's 9% share, of course, comes from American programming, which I should also throw in. Steve, if he's going to start throwing around share numbers, I'll throw that back
out. Maybe I should get up.
Moving right along, you all operate foreign bureaus, and we have seen in the last little while that it looks like more and more stations are shutting down their foreign bureaus. And I'm wondering, Wendy, is that the way we're going to go?
I disagree with that. You know, we haven't shut down foreign bureaus. I think how we cover foreign news is different. I don't think foreign bureaus are ever going to go away. Absolutely not. I think it's different, though. Gone are the four-man crew that we used to send out, the cameraman, the sound man, the producer, the reporter. You know, now all it takes is one person with a smartphone. Or two people, and that's how we're going to cover our news foreign-wise. We just don't do it as large as we used to. But absolutely, foreign news is one of the most important things we do, and we will continue to do that.
But is it, of course, but do you want to do it by having your own people in your places?
Absolutely.
As opposed to
absolutely.
Just...
Absolutely. We cover the world through Canadian eyes, and that's very important for us.
Troy?
Yeah, I think the we operate a number of foreign bureaus. We're in London, we're in Beijing, we're in New Delhi, and we're in Washington. But the reality is to actually have someone on the ground in every place, particularly when, you know, we are very much focused on a much more community, local point of view, is challenging. And it's not necessarily challenging as much from the budget point of view as it is from the size of the news hole that's available. The appetite for news in some locations is simply reduced. So we use our foreign bureaus to, and the technology and the ease of transportation and airline hubs have allowed you to do that, where you can send crews in, you can report in depth, you can work with local teams to get the most accurate information, and provide that context without having to be in all locations at all times.
I don't want to sound like I'm picking on you guys, because the newspaper people are, of course, shutting down their bureaus. We've seen that happen over the last little while. Budgets are budgets. Is it happening at CBC?
Sure. We in Jerusalem, we had, not that long ago, a producer, a camera person, an editor, and a reporter. So four people. Now we have one person, Sasha Petrasik, who's now in Gaza on his own. A bit of help, actually, because it was Gaza, but shooting, producing, editing, all on his own. So absolutely would echo what Troy and Wendy said about having to still keep that footprint, but in an age of diminishing budgets, manage it somehow. Other thing I would mention is that certainly Brian Stewart, who you may know, used to work for us at the National a number of years ago now, mostly with the Monk Center, still comes back and does things for us. Interesting story with him was there certainly at the CBC, and I'm sure other broadcasters, there's a sense that why can't you just cover this stuff from Canada? And Brian, when I was at the National, we had Brian doing Afghanistan largely from Canada. Incredible work on the conflict, on how it was unfolding, where it might go, largely from a Canadian base. And so he actually was called upon at sort of senior levels of the CBC to sort of talk about, well, Brian, you can do that. Why, if you can actually cover Afghanistan from Canada, why is that something we can't do more of? And his answer at that point, which I always remember, was, you know, that's the only reason that I can do it is that I've actually been in these countries. So he spent a number of years as a foreign correspondent, was out covering foreign stories, and so it's that sense of actually having been in places and understanding places, which allows you to be able to still cover those things and have a knowledge when you come back. The notion that people that have never been out, who have never only based here, can have that same kind of insight is flawed, I think. So I think it's always going to be a balance.
I would agree with Jonathan.
Again, to look at the newspapers, the Globe and Mail brought Martin. Yeah. Brought Patrick, he's home. He's here now, and he covers the Middle East from here and flies in as needs be. Is that the future in television?
I hope not. I hope that we can keep our foreign bureaus open forever. We do still do fly people in sometimes depends how big the story is, from Toronto and elsewhere. But, I just think we just have to be a little more nimble in these countries.
Do you know what percentage of your audience really goes to you for foreign news, Troy?
It's not huge. We've done surveys in terms of what the audience actually likes. Usually foreign news is down near the bottom. We also know that oftentimes when we survey people with what they like, they don't always give us the most accurate answers.
Because they want to seem smarter than they really are, or what? Yeah?
And it depends what the story is. Mm-hmm. It could be a foreign story that really resonates back home.
most of
well,
your...
I should say, the week of the U.S. election, a couple of weeks back, the national newscasts on all three networks saw their biggest numbers of the past year. They were the largest numbers, and now that was an American story, which is foreign, I know, but not as foreign as, say, going to the heart of Africa. But there is obviously an appetite for what goes on outside of Canada's borders. And I should just say, we've gone from 2 foreign bureaus 10 years ago to 5 now. We're increasing.
Okay. Let's do a couple more questions here, and then we'll get the audience involved. Let's try this. Most of your viewers, I gather, are still on conventional television, but your largest increases are presumably all in the digital world, in the online world. So I want to know how you, Wendy, you first, how are you balancing the investments that you need to make in all of your different platforms, recognizing the fact that the future is here, but most of the viewers are still here?
We are investing heavily in digital. And I think what Jonathan said earlier, it's very important that it be a companion with our newscasts. We're very involved in social media. We always talk about the four screens, the smartphone, the laptop, the tablet, and the TV set. And I think it's very important that it become a companion when you're watching television. You know, but I'll still say, I still don't think that anyone has found that secret sauce, though, how to make a lot of money off of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's still something yet to be found, as the newspapers know they certainly haven't. Yeah. And neither have we. You know, maybe someone has that secret magic bullet, or we certainly haven't. But we absolutely are paying a lot of attention to digital. It's, you know, one of our biggest things now, but it needs to be a companion with the television.
Troy, how are you handling those?
Well, first off, I want to dispel the notion that conventional television is not worthy of investing in either. We have, in the last year and a half, added 110 hours of news to our conventional television programs.
So have we. We've added a lot of numbers, a lot of hours of news.
And so we're at a point where we're trying to meet the audience expectations of being there when they want it. So part of that is making sure, so really our conventional television and our digital strategies are going hand in hand, in that we want to ensure that we're there when they wake up in the morning. So we've added morning shows in every market across the country. We want to be sure whether they're there at the end of the day. And we're trying to take parts of what were fairly unproductive hours on the conventional schedule. And if you watch weekend mornings, for instance, on many of the networks, you'll see a lot of infomercials and that kinds of thing. We think those are places where there's actually a good news audience to be had, and we're investing in that kind of program. We've expanded weekend morning news. We're adding news into all kinds of hours where it wasn't before. That's possible because technology is allowing it to be possible, and we're able to repurpose put more reporters out into the field, add more hours of programming into those hours, and at the same time, take those same stories and push them out on the digital platform. So we are seeing parallel growth.
Jonathan, how does it work at CBC?
I think the main goal for us is to look at the operation overall and to find areas where there is duplication and where there are people doing similar things. Find those, eradicate them, and then reinvest those resources into digital. So it's not a question of adding on resources, it's a question of moving things. So for example, we started not that long ago something called the Alert Desk, where it's a very small three-person at any time team who take information from across the country that people deliver and disseminate it everywhere. So one person will write a one-line alert, which will appear automatically on people's Twitter, email alerts. It will go on the slider on News Network at the top of the web page in terms of an alert. So it is really trying to figure out, in terms of commodity news and things that we have to report on, breaking news, sort of the price of admission for any news operation in terms of serving the public, and doing that with the fewest number of people possible, which will allow us then to find areas where we can be where we can redirect resources to serve digital. Because it's not a question of adding on. Obviously, as you say, the money's not there. It is a question of redistribution and moving resources around.
Did you hear what the newspaper editors said about CBC.ca when they were here a month ago?
I did hear what they said.
They hate you.
They do.
Because you're good.
Right. Yeah.
That's why. You have a problem with that?
I don't have a problem. Absolutely, we are. I know their argument, but we're a public service organization. We're here for public service, and we will serve everybody in any way that we can, everywhere that we can, and not to do that would be in many ways foolish. I was talking earlier about something that I learned about last week in Austria, where the government-supported broadcaster there is being banned from certain aspects of Facebook and Twitter in order not to compete with the newspapers, which is insane in a sense. I understand from the newspaper's perspective why they would push that, but it's absolutely crazy. I mean, we have to serve. You can't You can't be serving people on television or just on radio or just online. You have to be everywhere, and we provide public service.
It's an interesting question on mandate, though, because for those who missed it, really the complaint is that CBC, with its $1.2 billion in taxpayer appropriations, is now building a competitive business that is taking eyeballs away from newspapers, which are desperately struggling in the digital space. I mean, this is a battle that private broadcasters have dealt with for a long time, and we work in a regulated world, so there's an acceptance that we have been issued licenses and we operate under a regulated environment, and we understand that there's a private broadcasting sphere and there's a public broadcasting sphere. It didn't say anything about the new media area, where suddenly you're opened up to competition against a bunch of others, but it's something we're always struggling with, and in Britain, Ofcom weighed in, right? They came back to the BBC and said, cut it back. Cutting into private businesses and making them less viable.
Do you think the CBC should not be allowed to be online?
It would be in a sense like asking the Toronto Star or the Globe Mail not to do video on their websites. How would they respond to that? They obviously understand the need to be in that sphere in the same way that we understand the need to be in what they're doing. And so it just doesn't make any sense in terms of how we could operate or how we could be seen as a viable news organization in this country.
Wendy?
I'm not going to comment.
That seems like a good place to leave it. Okay. We've set the table for you folks. So there's a microphone in the middle of the room. Let me remind everybody that if you're tweeting on this event or if you're catching us on Twitter or online, we're happy to take your questions right now. We can put some of those from our audience watching us online to our three guests here, and we would welcome anybody who wants to come to the microphone in the middle of the room to start things off. Now, who's going to be brave and do that? We'll sit here and wait. Who's going to be brave? Oh, we got some from online. Very good. Thank you. Okay. Do you want me to say names or no? Does it matter? Yeah, identify them. Here's Graham Harris, who says, there's no mention of demographics in the discussion of the audience. Okay. What do they want to know? No mention of demographics.
Well, I think I'll go at that one, because the challenge in news, particularly in broadcast news, is that all three of our national newscasts in particular, the demographics are a little better for local news, but in national news, it's upwards of two-thirds of the audience, sometimes 70-80%, are in the 55-plus demographic. Advertisers don't want to pay for the 55-plus demographic. Now, part of that's just agency history. They don't like paying for the 55 demographic. They've got it free for all these years, and they're not going to start paying for it now. But it presents a tremendous challenge to news in that the shows with half or a third of our total audience are actually viewed as better advertising propositions than the newscasts are, because they deliver more 18 to 49.
And really the magic number is 25 to 54. That's what the advertisers love. And news is watched, as Troy said, by more people over the age of 55.
Is that who your audience is at 11 o'clock overwhelmingly?
Absolutely. 55 plus. And we're always trying to get the younger audience.
How about at 10 o'clock?
Of course,
it's the same thing?
It's the same phenomenon in the U.S. You'll notice watching 6:30 newscasts in the U.S.
It's all ads for drug companies.
Absolutely, yeah. It's the kinds of things that are advertised are really indicative of the audience.
If they allowed, in Canada, you are not allowed the super PAC type political advertising,
right,
which in the U.S. almost exclusively targets, or drug advertising, Viagra ads, Cialis, all that stuff. If they allowed those in Canada, our news revenues would skyrocket.
That's right.
Why don't they allow it?
Well, it's prevented by Health Canada regulations for drug advertising, single-payer system, and the political advertising is prevented under Elections Canada.
Hmm. Yeah.
Question here.
I think there's more.
Can we get this mic on here?
You can just come up and sit with us if you like.
Or I'll speak loud.
There you go. We got you on.
So the idea that there's more content than there ever was, I think that's clear. That, the content's still king, if you will. Why do you believe that the distribution has to be through kind of cable television? Why can it not just all be distributed through the internet? So the same content that you're producing and just kind of blow up the tube kind of notion. And I'm just curious what your thoughts about that kind of transition, because there's an inherent cost in that structure. It's almost like in a newsroom that there's an inherent cost around how you produce it. And if you got rid of, I'd hate to say half the, technical people, then you'd be able to do it on a certain scale. So it's just an open-ended question.
I think for us, in the end, what we spend most of our time thinking about is the audience. How do we serve them? And at the moment, it could change. It could change, soon. It could change later. My sense is it's probably going to be later. For the moment, there is still a huge interest from the audience in appointment viewing on television. So a certain time and a certain channel. And so we have to serve that audience. And to the extent that that's necessary, we'll have to continue doing that. Doesn't mean that we aren't doing things like at the CBC, for example, shutting down analog transmitters, going digital, that sort of, you know, doing things that do save money and that do make sense. But in the end, there is still a large market for people who watch on television. And, you know, take a look at televisions. They're getting bigger, not smaller, right? So there still is an audience for people who not only want to watch on a screen, but a bigger screen, which requires a certain amount of bandwidth and a certain amount of ability to deliver that kind of content. So it's not a question of either or. It is a question of somehow delivering to everybody, which becomes extremely complicated to manage. But we're not at the point yet where we can abandon traditional television delivery of news.
I think the real answer is monetization. And while the online guys at our shop will celebrate if they, you know, they get, oh my God, we got 50,000 people on that live stream. You know, the three national newscasts in this country every single night get 3 million viewers total. It is a lot of people you can get through broadcast as opposed to the more narrowcast stream on the internet. We also know the advertisers are willing to pay about 10 times as much for the same impression on television as they are on the internet, and that's because the belief is that when you're engaged, you're sitting down, you're watching, you are much more engaged with that ad than you are if you've got 15 other things going on and you're clicking and you can get through it. So there's a whole monetization.
Troy, when Troy says 3 million, too, that's the important thing to remember, too. That's 3 million people, an average minute audience.
Per minute.
So that's 3 million people who are watching essentially the entire newscasts of all the three broadcasters. Some of the online numbers, which we'll talk about, impressions or page views, are really jumping in to look at however long it takes to read a page. There's a lot of time spent with conventional television broadcasters in the country. That's 3 million people spending a full hour, full half hour with the product, and that's a lot of people.
And the other thing on monetization is nobody has yet devised a better subscription model than just having it tacked onto your cable bill every month. Mm-hmm. And that's how, you know, a huge chunk of the CBC News organization is funded through CBC News Network, and a slightly smaller chunk of the CTV News organization.
Should you guys be concerned if 3 million people per minute are watching your news? That's 10% of the population, so 90% of Canadians are not watching you at all?
No, we're talking the average measured audience.
If you added our reaches, which is how many people tune in for 5 minutes per week, we'd probably be pretty close to 20 million, I would think.
Yeah, in terms of the actual reach?
The reaches are huge.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Much bigger. That's
the difference between the per minute audience and the total reach.
Yeah,
right. Gotcha. We're a TVO. We don't slave over ratings as much as you guys do. Okay.
I don't think I'm not
you
sure
beat me
the
to
CBC
my jokes.
we do.
There was a little bit of a follow up. I think it was Radio Canada who's talking about having their children's programming, requesting that the children's programming be online only. I mean, I have a young child. My mothers do. We basically never turn on the TV anymore.
Not even TVO.
Yeah.
Not even
Pokeroo.
But online. Definitely through the web, there's lots of good stuff. So it's that, that very specific one. The idea is that they're asking for a mandate, if I'm not mistaken, something to that effect to say, you know what, we're going to basically free up that tube time and put it on online only. And the reason I'm referring to children's programming, it's kind of leading, let's say, where things are going in another direction, because you've got that certain demographic that'll always be attached to the television.
Let me pull a question out of this, if I can, Stavros. You two have your own all-news channels.
Yes.
Are you getting pressure, as the question suggests here, to take some of the news that you do on conventional television now and move it over either to your all-news channels or
absolutely.
To your web? Yes?
Absolutely.
Where does that pressure come from?
Well, because, you know, from the top, because the fact of the matter is, when we put stuff on the main network, it takes away revenue. So it's got to be really big, like an election or, you know.
You can make more money with other things besides news.
Yeah, and we have a news channel to put the news on. And, you know, I noticed, though, at the American election, which I don't recall ever, maybe you guys have, the American networks were up with the election, and they took commercials, and they had sponsorships. Yeah. Well, we never do that. We sustain. We don't take commercials. And the Americans never used to take commercials. But now all the Americans are up with their election coverage on their main network, and they are going to commercials, and they have had sponsorships. Now, that's the first time I ever saw that.
Do you think they held their audiences through those commercials, or do you think people flipped
away?
I think they did.
But they made money off of it. You know, when our last election campaign, we certainly didn't go to commercials. We didn't have sponsorships. And I'll be honest, this is something that we may look at next time around.
Jonathan?
Some pressure, but in the end, there's a couple of things in terms of moving what's on the cable news channel onto the main network. First of all, local news. Hmm. Obviously, no one's figured out a way to do local news on a cable news network, so that's a huge part of particularly for Wendy and Troy, well, for all of us in the end, local news is hugely important, and so that's a definite reason to stay on the main channel. And also, as there are more platforms and more places you can get the news, those individual platforms have to be directed and very specific in what they do. So news network for us is all about, if it's happening, we're on it. So it's very much a live news channel now, a live news wheel to a certain extent. And so you can see 10 years ago where there was something like 50 hours of live news programming on a news network, now it's 100 hours. And so as we have more platforms, each individual platform has to be more directed at a certain audience. So another reason to, you know, to say that we need both news on a news channel and on the main network.
And I'm going to answer John's question a little more succinctly than John did, because last Ontario election, public broadcaster, if it has one raison d'etre, it is to cover an election.
That's right, it is.
It ran a hockey game on conventional and said, "Watch News World if you want to see the election."
You want to come back on that?
Well, it was
it wasn't
then,
even a Saturday night. It's not like elections are held on Saturday nights.
Since then, Steve, every provincial election has been on News Network, and that was a very specific instance where the Ontario government held an election on the same night as the opening doubleheader in the hockey season, and
right.
So put us in a bit of a box. In the end, though, we were able to provide it on the news channel. I think
subscribers, far
from being contradictory to my point, I think it kind of reinforces it that's what the news channel is for. You know, it's things that are unfolding, things that are live, things that are happening, and the main network is more for, in terms of the national marketplace, the fifth estate, depth, context.
So hockey is more of a public service than elections. Okay.
You don't agree with the call?
No, it was a bad call. It was a terrible call, especially for the CBC.
Okay. Stavros, thank you for the question. We're about to be knighted. Go ahead.
My name's Tim Knight. Steve, delightful to see you doing your job again, this time in real life. The mission of this evening was the Keeping You on the Tube, the mission of broadcast news. I don't think we've really handled that very much. I don't think we've handled anything about how to keep people on the tube, which I assume was why we were all gathered here. Now, you mentioned Twitter, you mentioned Facebook, you mentioned citizen journalists. Yeah, they're all there, and they throw some facts out. Some of the facts are true, as was mentioned. Some of the facts are untrue. Journalists bring that stuff together. That is our job. That is what we are trained for, to bring understanding. That is ultimately what we are supposed to do. And my suggestion to you all to answer the how to keep people watching us is to do far better storytelling. Far better storytelling than any of, certainly you three and your people.
Tim, help
do.
Us out. Help us Sir. Out. What do you mean by far better storytelling?
Storytelling is the most ancient way we have of passing on information.
What are they not doing right about how they tell
another.
Stories?
What?
What are they not doing right about the way they tell stories?
Oh, hell, they almost always start at the end. Then they work back to the beginning, by which time you've forgotten what happened at the end. Night after night after night, we have stories that have no structure, that have no logical structure. And the logical structure of storytelling is a sense of drama. How is this going to happen? How will it turn out?
Which of these three networks is the most egregious at doing what you've said? Well, because I'm going to start with that person to defend themselves.
The one I love most, which is CBC, for which
okay.
I worked
Stand
for
by.
Many years.
Stand by.
God.
Do you have a problem with storytelling and the way
and,
he is
And
described?
Which I'm reminded, I trained for many years, too.
Yes, yes. Okay.
But they have forgotten it, sir.
Stand by. Let's get an answer to your question.
Well, they didn't have it then.
Okay, up here.
No, Tim
Jonathan.
Trained me when I joined the CBC 25 years ago.
I have apologized.
on how to tell a story.
I'm going to jump to his defense now.
Yeah, thank you very much. And it was a challenge back then, though. I think good storytelling is not easy, Tim, right? And it wasn't easy back then. I don't think it's any easier now. I don't think anything that we've done in those 25 years, though, has diminished the capability to tell good stories. It's not like we don't still have people committed to that. There are lots of people who talk about the package, whatever you want to call it, 2-minute news package is a dying art. I don't see any indication of that. I don't think in my time in terms of being involved in television news, that's going to go away. So what we do is we train people. We have storytelling courses. We do push this. Certainly on the radio side, because we're fully integrated now at CBC, there are people who defend the craft very vigorously.
Yes.
and push strongly around storytelling. And certainly there's an aspect of what we do on the news channel which is more about what's happening now and giving people a sense of what's going on at that moment. But we still have a large amount of resource committed to storytelling. It may not always be, you know, the best. It may be an art form that requires more vigor in defending, but we're certainly still there. We're certainly still pushing. We're not giving it up, and I can't see us giving it up anytime soon.
Let me ask Wendy. You've heard his criticism.
I encouraged him to turn the channel and watch CTV.
I do, however, and I have written about the storytelling on CTV as well.
I do think that you're right about storytelling. I think storytelling is the most important thing we have to do, and that is something that will keep network television alive, is good storytelling.
Yes.
And it's so important, and we tell that to our reporters every day, because in the end, that's what we're about.
Yes.
And I'm glad you brought that up, actually.
Thank you, ma'am.
And I'm going to say to Tim, we've got a news director job open in Toronto right now. I'm actually fully in agreement.
I was news director once for CBC. I wasn't very good at it.
I agree. I mean, I think it is an ongoing criticism that our news managers have of our reporters when they come back. And it's like, hey, what's the real story here? I think it is a symptomatic of too much watching the other guy. It's no secret that in all of our newsrooms, the competing channels are on, and we're seeing what they have, and there's too much of, oh, God, they've got that. Let's redirect to make sure we're covered off on the same base, instead of putting the resources into original contextual storytelling and adding some drama and telling the story beginning, middle, and end.
I also think the world is moving so fast, and news happens so fast, and that's part of the problem, too, is nobody stops and just says, okay, let's stop for a minute and think how I'm going to do this. We're always rushing to the next thing. And I think that's part of it.
I don't think
there are no deadlines anymore. The deadlines are now.
No.
Every second is a deadline, and that's a problem.
The art hasn't disappeared, that's for sure. We're seeing graduates of journalism schools coming out with this wonderful suite of skills, not only as fantastic storytellers, but also tremendous technical skills. I think where the art gets challenged is in the industry of it. And particularly with the 24/7 demand to keep churning out the information, and it's really storytelling by adding one more fact, and then 10 minutes later, here's one more fact, then an hour later, here's two more facts, and the beauty of the story sometimes gets lost. That's where I think the really nice thing about the national newscast is, and that's the place to add contest and to add that the beauty of the story back in, and it's a good reminder for all of us.
Yes, please.
Hey, my name is Amanda. I'm a producer at News Talk 1010, and I was just noticed that you guys all kind of agreed that your target audience is older than you may want or need it to be, and this is something that all traditional news outlets are dealing with right now. So are you actively trying to change your newscast in any way to get a younger audience, and if so, how are you doing it?
Amanda, which show are you producing at 1010?
I currently produce the Jerry Agar Show.
Jerry Agar?
Yes.
Well, you admit that in public, too. Good for you.
I try to balance them out a little, you know.
No wonder she's asking about having an old audience.
Well, and that's why I'm his producer. I'm 23 years old, so I think that's kind of one way that CFRB is trying to change things up. So
I don't think you're allowed to say CFRB anymore.
Well, I
News
just
Talk
did.
Yeah, Brandon.
Yeah.
Okay, who wants in on this?
Well, the target audience, I think, will be wrong. I think it's the audience that exists right now for conventional television news. So absolutely, we are trying whatever we can and have been, I think, all of us for a number of years. And it's about finding stories that are relevant, finding new ways of telling stories. It is about new media. It is about, you know, being in all of these places. It is about providing news on television, but also providing news on mobile, wherever we can do it. So absolutely, target, I think it's the wrong word. We are, you know, we have that audience to a certain extent. It is trying to grow the audience that is younger, for sure. And we're all trying hard at that.
Yeah, I think we do. And I think that you know, as teenagers, I've got teenagers at home, they are now starting to watch news. And I believe that the 18 to 49 will start to watch news. And I've seen it in some of our news channels, our CP24 and News Channel. We have really good ratings, 18 to 49.
Wendy, what do they watch?
Pardon?
What news do they watch?
Well, they're just tuning in and out on CP24 and News Channel. And we noticed our numbers, 18 to 49, on those two channels do really well.
Do they watch CBC ever?
My kids?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
We have a pretty good younger audience on News Network for the National, which is interesting. It's a little different than the main.
It is. It's a younger audience on our news channel.
It has to do with the nature of the broadcast. I saw, not that long ago, a news broadcast. I think this was another country, that was a pretty typical news broadcast that we would all recognize. But it was on a channel that was for younger kids. It was like a music channel or something like that. So a lot of it has to do not so much with the form necessarily, but where it is, and for some reason. news network attracts a younger audience, particularly around the national. So it might be where it's parked as opposed to exactly the nature of the broadcast itself.
Got it. And just specifically, like, I don't mean to harp on your numbers or whatnot, and your numbers might be great, but you're always wanting to increase your audience. So specifically, are you reaching out? Are you happy with your numbers then for your 18 to 24? Or are you trying to?
We're always trying to get more audience.
Right. So are there any specific? Yeah. Are there any specific ways you're actually looking?
Well,
at your
newscast? Well, we're doing a lot of social media, and you know, we talked before about companion with digital, and you know, as much promotion as we can, and yeah, we're always trying new things, and you know, but putting the digital together with the smartphones and all of that is a big component, absolutely, to get those younger eyes because they are there.
Yeah. Thanks, Amanda.
Thanks.
Tell Jerry to chill, okay?
He's actually not that bad.
Okay. Yes, please.
Hi. We talked about age demographics. My question is for the public broadcasters here, CBC and TVO. And it's about another demographics, which is immigrant population in Canada. And my question is, do you have any plans to engage them more in Canadian current affairs, because of ease of communication, they usually stick to the news from their homeland, and they very slowly transition to the Canadian politics. So, they, because of the language barrier or because they don't know the background of the stories, do you have any plans to offer a special news?
Can I just ask a follow-up? Do you feel those audiences are now not being adequately engaged by public broadcasters?
My own anecdotal research has proved that they stick to the ethnic media, which is because of the pre-existing interest, they only report from the homeland, and they very rarely report from Canadian politics in a way that makes them an engaged and informed citizen who can go and participate in the mainstream politics of Canada.
Let me get something from John. Jonathan, you want to tackle
that? Yeah, so we had, changed the national up a few years ago and had worked at that point at trying to deliver that particular broadcast in different languages. So that was a strategy that we had. We're still working on how we can actually make that happen. You see that at CBC in terms of Hockey Night in Canada, broadcasting in different languages. Beyond that, and you know, that creates difficulties in terms of resources and how do we actually do it. We're certainly in all of our programs trying to reflect those communities. You think of Metro Morning on radio, particularly in Toronto, listening into it on any particular morning, you do get a real sense of what this city is. And we try to pull people in that way from those communities by making sure that they're reflected on the airwaves. We do that on our newscast as well.
That's the number one radio show, isn't it?
It is the number one radio show in the morning. And so we're definitely trying to make sure that people in, you know, that the city of Toronto is reflected in those broadcasts in a way that actually reflects what the city's, the makeup of the city. But beyond that, nothing specific in terms of additional channels or additional outlets, but really just trying to make sure that what we have now is reflective of the Canada that we actually live in.
I want to jump on that one because I think the, and Wendy talked earlier about being able to do things as part of a big vertically integrated bell that they hadn't been able to do before. One of the things we've done as part of Shaw is we've launched a Mandarin version of our national newscast, a Global National in Mandarin. And it's only available over the Shaw cable systems because that's the only delivery mechanism we have for it. But the uptake has been tremendous. And that's largely because the existing Mandarin newscasts, as you say, are often heavily weighted towards news from on the other side of the world or from a very localized kind of perspective. This allows the pan-Canadian national network perspective in a different language, and it's been incredibly well received, and the numbers are good for it, too. So.
Let me get a couple of questions in. Thank you for that question. Yes, just give me 1 second. I want to get a couple of online questions here. Wendy, how much does the lead-in show matter to your news audience?
Good question. I would hope not much. We still get a big amount of people, even if the lead-in is low. We always bring it up because, again, it's appointment viewing. People want to watch the national news. So, you know, absolutely it matters, but we still get a huge amount of viewers that tune in every night no matter what.
Troy,
no matter what the lead-in is.
Your supper hour show?
It's not huge, so we definitely, you know, if you have a good lead-in, you're going to get better numbers just because you're going to hold some of them over through promotion in that show, but the vast majority of our tune-in is show-specific. People are flipping it on to see the news.
Does your lead-in for 10 o'clock matter?
You know, looking at numbers generally, yes, but I would agree with Troy that it's not the make it or break it. And in the end, for those of us who produce the show, it can't be used as an excuse or an advantage. I mean, we really have to do the best show that we can possibly do for people that are watching. So it's not what we look at necessarily.
Gotcha. Wendy, what are broadcasters learning, if anything, from newspapers about video?
Good question. How easy it could be sometimes for them to gather it, because they just have they have their still photographer out there who's got a tiny little camera who's shooting everything, you know, where we still have the big camera and the tripod and the whole thing, and because of technology, those little cameras are incredible. Sometimes it's as good as what we shoot.
So is the $40,000 Betacam going to be a thing of the past?
I hope not.
Because?
Because we still provide better quality than that.
It's not just...
And we're still out there, with our two-person team and sometimes three-person team, and the quality is still much better what we shoot than what they shoot.
It's not a question just of quality. And we're not learning necessarily just from newspapers. We're learning from our audience and what they want, and from folks that we have working online who have a really good sense of this. And it is a different world. It's not, you're not shooting to create a package or shooting to necessarily tell a story with the traditional cinematic techniques that go back 100 years. You are sometimes shooting a minute of video, for example. If you're at a fire, you're shooting long periods of time, getting a sense of it as you move around, as opposed to cutting it for editing. So it is a question of learning what kind of video works online, and it is different. It's a different kind of not just quality, but how you shoot it and the kinds of things that you shoot, and staying on things for a long time, which, as you know, on television isn't going to work, but online is gold for
That's
people
right.
that are
it's
looking
It's very
online.
Different mediums, too.
Gotcha. Yes, thanks for your patience. Go ahead.
No problem. My question is possibly in two parts, depending on your answer. Online, where do your audiences go most? What do they read most, articles, or do they watch videos more?
For us, they watch videos more.
Troy,
but
how about
short
you?
Videos, not long ones.
Yeah, I mean, if you actually look at the number of clicks, and I'm be stunned if there were more people clicking on video than actually just reading stories, but time spent, video, yeah. But it's about 10 to 1. For every 10 articles read, it's one video watch, but they may just be scanning the article and going deep on the video. What they don't watch a lot of is the actual newscast. We find people who, when we post the entire newscast on, they watch maybe the first block, but it's pretty rare for people to sit and watch the full 60 minutes or 30 minute program online. It's just because the viewer experience is so much better on television that they wouldn't do
that. They watch the stories that they wanted to see from
the
newscast. Stories.
It's very story.
You guys have got them segmented by stories, and therefore they can get what they need right away. John, how about you?
Text is still king. Stories are still king. Written
text.
Stories. Yeah.
On cbc.ca.
Yeah.
Follow up?
Okay, well, in that case, I guess, how are you investing in the online part? So are you trying to spend more time on the video as well, so making shorter, more, YouTube-friendly-ish kind of videos? Or are you using more of your resources on text? And are you trying to kind of make that the priority as opposed to that, sort of rushed take on news?
Just to follow up earlier, I think having said that, text is king and people come for stories, the video thing is definitely where we're investing, and it's not so much adding people, it is understanding, as I mentioned, what kinds of video people want online and making sure that video gets on quickly. So we're all three of us worked earlier in a world where video was gathered and kind of kept up through the afternoon, to the point where it had to be edited 4 or 5 hours later, sometimes 8 hours later. So the goal for us now is to get it on quickly. And so definitely a concentration is on not so much putting packages on the news, although we all chop our newscasts up and deliver it that way. It is taking raw video that happens on the scene as news unfolds, and getting it on the site as quickly as possible. So that's where the investment is. Not so much an investment in additional people, but an investment in understanding how do we change people's sense of how they work and workflow and how things happen, and getting that video that's raw and getting it on right away, because that is what people are looking for.
Troy?
I was going to say, the question of whether we're going to put more resources into video or text, it's actually both and neither. And that where we're really trying to take our websites is to be platform-specific type of journalism, things that We want to cater to our television audience with the stuff that's best on TV, mm-hmm. big pictures, big context. The stuff that's best online is the kinds of things you can interact with. That's why we're doing much more data journalism, much more the kinds of stories where you can pinpoint how it impacts your neighborhood, your region. You can interact with it, where the text is actually broken up with storifying, with tweets, and with video. And to really cater to a very specific kind of online consumption instead of trying to repackage the video, the TV video experience onto the web, or repackage the newspaper experience onto the web.
Gotcha. Yes, thanks a lot. Let's do one last question, and then we'll save some time for everybody to just kind of get together and meet informally. Go ahead.
Sure. My name is Rihanna, and I'm from Ryerson, a student at Ryerson. Wendy, my question is for you. I know that Vancouver is one of three markets that CTV's local newscast doesn't dominate, and I was just wondering if that's the reason, or if that has anything to do with the firings of the general manager and the news director last week.
I'm not going to comment on that. We don't comment on what we do internally.
Just thought I would try.
But give her a job. That's moxie. Yeah, I like that.
I like balding, but no, I'm not going to.
You're a student at Ryerson?
Yeah, I am. Fourth year.
Fourth year.
Graduating next year, yeah.
I'm just, love to take advantage of this opportunity just to find out the world you're about to graduate into. How does it look to you?
Well, I'm actually not going into broadcast. I want to work in newspaper or magazine. So that's a little bit not on topic.
Think that's better?
No, I don't. It's just what interests me.
Do you want to do investigative journalism?
Maybe. Yeah, keeping it open.
You're daunted by the way that business is changing?
Newspaper a little bit. I mean, I think everyone likes to say, kind of wax poetic about how it's dying, but I interned at the Hamilton Spectator this summer, and it was a great experience, so I think that if I could get hired on a newspaper, I would be very lucky.
We wish you well.
Good luck.
And I know you all want to join me in thanking our three guests for coming here this evening and having such a nice discussion. Well done, everybody. Good job.
And I know you all want to join me in thanking Steve Paikin.
Yes. Well done, guys. Good job. Well done.
Hamilton's own Steve Paikin. So if you're so disposed, go to our website, cjf-fjc.ca, and donate. We need your support. Thanks again to BMO, Financial Group, and Waste Management. And join us for some refreshments. And thanks to the Twitter audience. You were a great crowd.
Good stuff. Thank you.